Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
Episode 2 of Cosmos Magazine, Issue. God. It's the recent contribution. PP, particularly significance. Right. Hopefully exceed its global warming or cooling targets, I hope. And it is produced around the world. The DDP is the first global effort to identify pathways to net zero emissions. Development strategies. Let's go a pathway. The IDDRI Batil. And based on an innovative framework. Such a political document. Second, it presented modelling showing emission reductions consistent with the global limiting goal warming to 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. Models based on the efforts of all countries involved show cumulative greenhouse gases emissions between 2010 and 2050 in the range of 1,185 to 1,555 gigatons of CO2. This is consistent with a range identified by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change for a 50% likelihood of keeping warming to 2 degrees. Reducing emissions further would increase the likelihood, and Rasmussen and Batil colleagues argue in their paper that the pathways they've developed could be employed to get the figure closer to 1.5 degrees. The release of the paper is certainly timely. The first five-year review of the national contributions to the Paris Agreement is held in 2020. The DPP team, 2 years before the Paris Agreement's inception, and initially set itself a target of keeping warming to 2 degrees. Quote, at the time, the idea of 2 degrees Celsius and net zero by 2050 was quite nascent. This is Tommy Yankos of the Independent Research Organisation Climate Watch, Climate Works Australia. Quote, as the science has improved and our understanding of the impacts of 2 degrees Celsius warming, we've become to understand that we need to do more, and that was reflected in the Paris Agreement. End quote. The Paris Agreement invites countries to define their own contributions to the shared temperature goal in the context of their specific national capacities. A further requirement is for those contributions to become progressively more ambitious. To date, however, there has been a, quote, widely acknowledged lack of collective ambition, Walesman and Bratil suggest. The DPP's proposed pathways are designed to accelerate the national contributions to the 2020 review. The DDPP's core focuses on the well-established, quote, three pillars of decarbonisation, energy efficiency, energy decarbonation, and user migration to low-carbon energy providers. A major finding of its research was that country-specific uncertainties were not suitable for standard risk analysis. It concluded that a better approach was to have multiple strategies in place for decarbonisation that were contingent on different plausible futures. The uncertainties and questions varied. Canada, for example, was concerned with varying oil prices, whereas Italy addressed the social capacity acceptability of carbon capture and storage. Using the DPP's approach, Canada could design multiple strategies contingent on different oil price futures. Similarly, Italy could create different plans based on the public perceptions of CCCS. CCCS has not been... Yankos believes the DPP emphasis on engaging with stakeholders brought cohesion to these multiple futures. Quote, these processes itself wasn't just a piece of analysis research that was developed in isolation and then pushed out. It was something that was developed in collaboration with systematic efforts to engage stakeholders, he says. Quote, so where political cycles are inevitable, by engaging a broad base of stakeholders, we are able to ensure there was a buy-in and tangible action that can happen by keeping people along the journey. DPP has globalised these national concerns, employing a hybrid approach of such bottom-up endeavours with the overview of global assessment models. For cross-country comparison and global assessment, it has developed a collective, quote, dashboard to serve as a transparent aggregator of data. And it developed a novel approach called backcasting, using the input of 2050 of forecasting net zero emissions target. The method was used to calculate an emissions trajectory back to the present day. This reverse forecasting enabled policymakers to make decisions that directly related to the 2050 net zero and 2 degrees Celsius goals. Yankos describes backcasting as one of the significant improvements to Australia's emission reduction planning. Backcasting is really a break from the old idea of looking at incremental change, he says. Looking at the end goal and working backwards from that, you can align near-term planning with long-term goals. Under the DPP model, each country prepares a report describing its specific challenges. Carbon sequestration was a significant focus for Australia in the context of future global economy, with heavy carbon constraints. Quote, you know, of course, we won't be able to sell coal. The focus on sequestration is a reflection of the physical endowments of Australia relative to the other countries in question, which don't have the same options. Australia has more arable land per capita than any other 20 GT countries, offering significant potential for carbon forestry. Further improvements are needed to the DPP process in order to align with the goals in the Paris Agreement. These include taking into account all emission sources that were not explicitly covered. More ambitious benchmarks will also be required, and participation must be expanded to include more than 16 countries, but it's a good start. Well, that, I find that almost upsetting by the amount of doublespeak. Like when I'm in emergency, let's talk to Mickey. It is an emergency situation. Astro Katie, Katie Mack, is a theoretical astrophysicist who focused on finding new ways to learn about the early universe and fundamental physics. We are stardust and Big Bang dust. In 2017, the LIGO experiment detected gravitational waves from two neutron stars colliding. It sent electromagnetic and gravitational ripples through the universe and the astronomical community, beautifully put. This remarkable event, hotly anticipated in this way, would more than give us a few new data points about the death of stars. It fundamentally changed our understanding of where we and our constituent atoms come from. You may have heard before that we are stardust. And this isn't wrong, but it's not the whole story either. A star is fundamentally an alchemy machine. Beautiful. It starts as a giant ball of mostly hydrogen gas, slowly crushing its central regions with the pressure of its own gravity. The core of the star eventually gets so hot and dense it becomes a nuclear reactor, fusing hydrogen into helium. In the core of our sun, this process is converting hundreds of millions of tons of hydrogen to helium every second. And what we receive from sunlight is essentially just the waste heat from this reaction. This is how the vast majority of stars spend their lives, steadily burning themselves up, turning hydrogen to helium for billions of years. In their death throes, as they become red giants, they expel the outer layers and fusion flares up in bursts, making lithium, carbon, nitrogen, and a smattering of heavy elements. To fill the rest of the periodic table, though, we need stars with more massive than our own. Stars more than about 8 times as massive as the Sun contain the centre of a nuclear furnace that is burning unimaginably hot. After it tears through the supply of hydrogen at its core, it climbs up the list of elements burning helium, carbon, neon, silicon, until after only a few million years, the centre of the star is iron from the fusion of radiation, and the fusion of radiation has been puffing the star up. Finally runs out. What I was going to say here is that that's true, but you've got SNR, slow nuclear reactions, and fast nuclear reactions, neutron reactions. At that point, nothing can stop the star from collapsing to itself, resulting in a spectacular supernova explosion. The end, the center debris field, will be either a super dense neutron star or a black hole. This final explosion itself, rather than this interior burning, that creates the star's ultimate chemical legacy. For a brief moment, a shockwave explodes through the layers of the star, creating heat and pressure so intense that the blast from the front nuclear fusion carries the radioactive shell of new elements into the interstellar space. The universe is seeded with stardust, ready to coalesce in new stars, new planets, new life. For years, it was thought that the stellar deaths were the main mechanisms for metals and super heavy and other heavy elements. But metals like gold, platinum, uranium, supernovas are just the beginning. It's tiny, dense neutron stars that carry with it potential to explode across the rest of the periodic table. Which brings us back to LIGO detection. When the signal was first seen, astronomers around the world trained their telescopes on the part of the sky. The resulting observations showed it created by enough gold to outweigh the Earth several times over. So you could see the periodic table splurt out by looking at it. Isn't that amazing? I didn't know that part. But neutron star collisions are essential to our chemical origin story. We are born on unnatural violence in the stellar generations that came before our own. But there's more to the story. Most of the atoms in our bodies didn't come from stars at all. They are, in fact, much more ancient. If you count up all the atoms in your body, more than 60% will be hydrogen. And the majority of the hydrogen in the universe has never been in a star at all. Hydrogen, or specifically the protons, that would later join with the electrons to make primordial fire of the Big Bang itself, or DM. In the first moments of the universe, every nuclear plasma hotter and denser than the centre of even the most massive star. As this fire expanded and cooled, protons and neutrons and building blocks of atomic nuclear first came into being. Hydrogen appeared to be in the form of a solitary protons, along with small amounts of helium and lithium, and deuterium, of course. These nuclei have persisted for 13.8 billion years since the first moments coming together in stars and eventually us. So yes, you are stardust, but you are atomic alchemy brought together by the inexorable flow of gravity and time. It's very interesting to read that. I suppose link it with the trying to the basic science journalism of a smart box. Modern sat nav and ancient geodesy. Driving from Rome to Tuscany in a rented car, we were at the mercy of satellite navigation system. The first crisis when it indicated we were on an exit ramp and we knew we were still on the freeway. So we ignored it. After a few hundred metres, it nonchalantly considered that we were back on the freeway. Human judgment saved the day. But what if this had been a self-driving car? The problem is the civilian satellite navigation system, as implemented, is the most in most cars, has a wiggle room. It's only accurate to 10 metres. Fortunately, state-of-the-art technology upgrade is on the way. Surprisingly, delivery of far more accurate science and geodesy born in Greece from the struggling to decide between Homer's view of the world and the flat the view was flat and Pythagoras' view that was spherical. Now, I didn't know that. Homer. I'll have to really read out who Homer is. I know he wrote the Iliad and the Odyssey, but gee, I didn't know. And he had a flat world, isn't it? Amazing. And flat world, you can imagine if someone's writing a tale, it's best to have a flat world. Today, we know Pythagoras was right, but our planet is far from being a perfect sphere. And as another quirk, part of our quirk that bodes poorly for the 21st century, it needs for precision satellite navigation. The continents don't stay put. Geodesy is not a science that I often think about, but it is in my mind because I chair a section, selection panel for the Prime Minister's Prize for Science. And in 2018, the winner was one of the world leaders in geodesy, Carl Lindbergh. When started as a young geodesic science, Lindbergh never dreamed to be his chosen scientific discipline would be critical for enabler for self-driving cars. Driving is complex, challenging, and autonomous vehicles need everything working for them. They use video to help them follow lanes, radar used with microwaves. LiDAR uses light to measure distance to other cars and objects, and they will eventually talk to the other cars in their vicinities to determine their position, speeds and intentions, as well as city computers that control traffic signals, temporary speed limits and repairs. But what happens in snowy, wet conditions on a country road on a moonless night? With all its sensors blinded, the car will be totally reliant on sat-nav. Relying on today's system will likely see many autonomous vehicles drive unwillingly into a ditch. Tomorrow's sat-nav will shrink the wriggle room 100-fold to 10 centimetres, the width of a hand. It will keep cars well clear of ditches. Now that's interesting. To achieve such stunning positional accuracy, sat-nav systems will employ signals from ground-based stations to augment the satellite position data. The in-car devices will hone their accuracy by combining signals from the American and European satellite systems and perhaps the Russian and emerging Chinese systems. The invisible physics behind all of this, Einstein's theory of special relativity and atomic clocks, will enable satellites to know exactly where they are relative to each other and the mass of the Earth. But Einstein and physics and extraordinary technology are not enough. If you want to know exactly where you are on Earth, you need a perfect map. The original design of the GPS satellite navigation system was based on the advice of geodesic scientists working in the US Navy. Modeling of the shape of the Earth by geodesic scientists had been essential for knowing exactly where a grid point on the Earth lies relative to an orbiting satellite. And it works in reverse. By observing the slight shift in the orbit of the satellites, geodesic scientists have been able to accurately measure the flattening and bulging of the Earth as it responds to the forces constantly acting within, and the pull from the Moon. Isn't that amazing? Besides the planet's shifting dents and bulges, continents are on the move. Australia, for instance, is moving north at 7 centimetres a year. This means the precision of future satellite navigation systems will be wasted unless the terrestrial maps can be routinely updated to an equivalent level of accuracy. Geodesic scientists can call upon a huge variety of techniques to make this possible, such as very long baseline interferometry to measure the relative motion of the ground stations around the planet with the accuracy of better than 1 millimetre a year. From the roots in ancient Greek natural philosophy to Einstein's special relativity of theory of relativity, today's geodesic scientists call on a proud tradition of fundamental science to generate precision Earth maps which will underpin tomorrow's driverless cars. Isn't that amazing? Okay, I'll probably read, it's 20 minutes, probably read one more article. Suspended animation or suspended disbelief, including Tepor and hibernation in humans, could improve survival rates from heart attack to violence victims. It might also be the key for long-distance space travel, Paul Berger reports. So amazing. That is pretty amazing, isn't it? The twilight zone between life and death is no postcard destination. Isn't that beautiful? Take the flock of the camera, found an urban country life that sends snow drift during a deep freeze of Montana US winter. It resembled a trash shag carpet on arrival at the Capel Animal. The temperature didn't register. A gentle rewarming elicited was discharged in full feline health. She was likely in a state loosely caught in suspended animation. Where the need for oxygen is so low that even with breathing, vital organs such as the brain become unscathed. This happens to humans too. In 2006, Australian mountaineer Lincoln Hall was pronounced dead by the Sherpas of Mount Everest after showing no signs of life for 2 hours. Despite a full night at 8,800 metres with no oxygen, he was found next morning alive, if disoriented, by a fellow climber. The feats are not gone unnoticed by scientists. On extreme falling to buy time for patients whose hearts have stopped after shooting or stabbing. Others are hunting the switch that hibernating animals used and resources are scarce. There's intense interest too from space agents hoping human agents could solve the problem for a long space flight. 2001 reminds me. Who's center in Baltimore? Projects. Altercation, supposedly an argument about something related to bowling shoes, he says. But he got stabbed in the heart, and we actually got him to the operating room, but he kept on arresting, and we couldn't resuscitate him. The instance firm Tishman's resolved to study how cooling might give the surgeons time to sew up a punctured heart or blood vessel without their patients ending up brain damage from lack of oxygen. Initial work on dogs in the early 1990s had dramatic results. Our animal models was that we could bleed them to a point of cardiac arrest, and then we could cool them down and leave them in cardiac arrest for a period of time. One dog he recalled was an American coonhound. It's a full hour of recovery time, and the lab technician took it home as a pet. These days, Tishman's main research is on humans, and it could well change the way trauma is managed. He heads up a trial called Emergency Preservation and Resuscitation for Cardiac Arrest, EPRCAP, which is slated for completion in December. It also offers a chance at life to victims of penetrating trauma, including stabbing and gunshot wounds, who bleed to the point where it stops. Survival rate are notoriously low, 2-5%. A logistical feat. Surgeons open the patient's chest, pump upwards of 40 litres of ice saline into the aorta to chill the body down to 10 degrees Celsius. This, as they repair the damage, the second team connects the patient to a heart bypass machine, which pumps oxygenated blood to the patient's as warmed back up. The study's conclusion, pending, and Tishman's won't talk about the result. There is a reason to think, however, he may be up against it. Cooling research has been on something of a roller coaster in recent years, and someone ultimately familiar with the ride is Stephen Bernard. I've come to meet Bernard at Melbourne's Alfred Hospital, where he works as an intensive care physician. He walks me through the trauma centre to one of the three care unit that looks like looks after heart patients. An air ambulance has just landed in the adjacent helipad. Bernard excludes calm and quiet tension of beeping monitors and prostrate patients being unconscious of the typical entry requirement. His unsatisfied demeanor belies the fact that in 2002 he almost single-handedly changed the treatment of people whose hearts stopped outside the hospital after a heart attack. He led a study that found that if you cool those people by piling ice packs around them, nearly half survived to discharge from hospital. Of those not put on ice, only a quarter made it home. The study sparked a tectonic shift in the cardiac arrest treatment. Therapeutic hypothermia was the order of the day. My God, it keeps on going on. A photo from the era shows a patient presumably retrieved from the supermarket, buried under packets of frozen chips. All of that came crashing down in 2013, however, when a much larger study found cooled cardiac arrest patients died at the same rate as those kept at normal temperature. Bernard changed track. Instead of infusing ice saline into the veins of the cardiac arrest victims, they did worse. There was generally acceptance around the world from the correspondence we got. Yep, that's established that it's pretty definitely we're doing. We won't be doing that. Local paramedics no longer chill patients after cardiac arrest, but Bernard, who is also medical director of the Ambulance Victoria, maintains faith in the power of cool. He says the problem for heart attack patients may not be the cause of how you make them. The idea of taking the average 80-kilo human was going to be who is going to be 60 litres of water alone over, say, 5 minutes from 36 degrees. This is simply daunting, he says. Infusing litres of ice saline into someone having chest compressions, Bernard explains, could make it harder to generate the pressure gradient needed to move the blood around the body. So, does this bode ill for children? Necessarily, patients have blood litres making space to infuse icy fluids. Saline for the incision of the heart as the heart lung machine takes over, all which makes pumping into the blood streams workable. The challenge, nonetheless, it's not interesting that they did it and then they came across and they did a major study. The challenges, nonetheless, make a simple approach tantalizing. The dream of being able to inject something that slows everything down as a minute phase. As it happens, the dream fulfillment could well come in the guise of a hibernation research. Fritz Geiser, professor of zoology at the University of New England, New South Wales, he said it's hibernation and shortly daily tempo, at last less than 24 hours. In these states, animals drop the energy expenditure and reduce their metabolic rate to as low as 5% of normal. The body temperature plummets between 10 and 35 degrees Celsius. Tapo, I guess it tells me, is more common than you might think. We did estimate that 40% or so of terrestrial animals do it in Australia, he says. One such animal is the echidna, which Geiser explains it isn't just a winter chill, but bushfires that trigger tapo. Echidnas go from 32 to 4 or 5 degrees body temperature, really low, he said, adding. Is adapted for echidnas to be intimate after fires because the food is scarce and they don't need as much. And with the ground cover loss, they become sitting ducks to predators, hence the value of hiding in a burrow. But how precisely is the poor triggered? If it's supposed to be to smoke and support somehow, it's a stick which tells them to watch out. We don't know the neural signals, but we don't understand what triggers on tapu. Surprisingly, there are plenty of people who want to find out. Craig Franklin, professor of zoology in University of Queensland, Franklin studies animals with an extreme knack for observing parches. Frogs that live in the desert and burrow underground remain in a state of dormancy called avestation. They can last for years at a time. They don't feed, drink, or move. There are instances when there's been no rain and there's been a drought for 3 or 4 years. It rains, the frogs come out from nowhere. Franklin said, if you put frogs in a jar and a cupboard, it will go into avestation. In those dark confines, it can drop its oxygen consumption by almost 80%. That's impressive, but it has to go even lower for frogs to survive here without eating. The bush must have its own ingredients. In April, Frank's team began to hunt for it. The species that we work on burrows in really thick clay. This black soil that occurs in the Darling Downs. And one thing you notice, we're digging into that, when it's wet, that it smells of hydrogen sulfide, says Franklin. His interest in hydrogen sulfide is understandable because when it comes to lowering metabolism, rotten egg gas has formed. Hydrogen sulfide puts serious brakes on the process in which cells use oxygen and make energy. Adenosine triphosphate, ATP, something that happens in their pathways. Peter Reichmatter, professor of anesthesiology and intensive care medicine at the University Medical School Ulm, Germany, has been studying hydrogen sulfide for more than a decade. He has at his disposal a very special facility. Quote, we could probably be a unique institution in Europe that has a rodent as well as a large animal experimental intensive care unit, he says. In 2010, in ICU for animals, Reichmann did a study that blocked the blood flow to the kidneys of pigs for 90 minutes. The animals that got hydrogen sulfide ended up with less kidney damage, of course. Effectiveness on the razor's edge. Quote, the defense between manipulation as you like to have it on one hand and poisonous irreversible damage is extremely narrow, he says. In short, there is a fine line between hydrogen sulfide dose and that puts multicolonial power generation on a ghost slow and ones that blows up the plant altogether. So, restaurants that switched track looking for an existing drug with a clear safety profile. that liberates hydrogen sulfide. We may have a promising candidate. Apart from the use in gold mining, sodium triphosphate seems to have be one of the antidotes to human side poisoning. There you go. Sodium triphosphate. In research presented in March, Reichmesser's team treated a special kind of pig with sodium triphosphate. The animal had genetic mutations that lowers the availability of innate hydrogen sulfide. Mimicking the bleeding of traumas, they also had 30% of their blood volume drained. That would be fun. The triphosphate pig had significantly less lung damage than controls, suggesting the drug protects against the lack of oxygen and low blood flow. Triphosphate is promising, but I must admit, I was surprised, says Reichmesser, whose research was partly funded by the German Ministry of Defence. He is a doctor with the German Navy, and shortly after we speak, is scheduled to drop beneath the waves in a team with a team of submarines. Oh my God, it goes on. God. What then of the potential of triphosphate to help humans? Injured service personnel, for example. One could imagine that if there's no logistical hindrance, you could treat hemorrhaged soldiers in the battlefield using a molecule in the idea to buy time for a definitive management, says Rasmussen. He is, however, quick to temper expectations. This is really speculative and for the future. It's certainly not for next year. If Rasmussen is focused on the theatre of war, other researchers are looking to the stars. Matteo Crei, the physiologist in the University of Bologna, has been a consultant of the European Space Agency. He might have also discovered the hibernation switch. In 2013, he did an experiment that took him, took aim at the brainstem of rats. This region harbors a varied stuff of life. Central control room for breathing and heartbeat. Sarah's focus, however, was on the bean-shaped group of neurons at the lower end of the called the Raphael Felidus. Quote, when you activate this area, metabolism goes high and the body temperature increases, heart rate increases. It's like you have a fever, he says. This brainstem region looked like it could be a spot where you could turn off metabolism and on. Well, let's have a try. He did. The rats got a nano injection of muscimol, a drug that mimics the action of the brain's chemical messenger gamma aminobutyric acid GABA, I've heard of that one, straight from the Raphifidus, over Skype with a cheery Italian, see you, Sebastian, a cheery Italian inflection and some serious understatement. Cheery tells me the result was surprising and it worked the first time. The reps underwent major drops in brain temperature and heart rate. They became lethargic and all consistent with a state called sympathetic tapor. Siri, however, has his eyes on a bigger prize, one involving people on faraway planets. Quote, radiation is the number one problem for long-term space exploration, he says, referring to what are commonly known as cosmic rays. If you fly to Mars, you will get a high dose of radiation, like very significant. It won't kill you right away, but if it's high, if you consider to fly behind Mars, it's definitely going to kill you. Ceres explains that some hibernating animals are resistant to radiation damage, possibly because their tapor slows cell division and enhances DNA repair. That's a big reason why we want to replicate synthetic tapor in humans. We understand, though, that getting brain surgeons to do injections into human brainstem could be tricky. It's the very definition of surgical target country. He has therefore explored a different brain region of in experiments he is currently preparing for a journal submission. Quote, we know there is a network of neurons in the hypothalamus that looks clearly to be specifically activated in tapor. I believe that they are elaborating the energetic status of the animal, like brain calculates or computes the energy expenditure. and when the result of this computation is negative, when there is negative energy balance, the rapport is triggered. Searles tells me his data strongly supports the idea that fasting triggers rapport in mice through an effect on the raphe pedis via the hypothalamus. See you, Mary. I didn't even know you were there. Okay. The upshot is that he is chasing down existing drugs that could target the hypothalamus. He has a cocktail in mind and hopes to trial in mice. And if it works, he tells me, he could one day solve another niggling challenge of long-distance space travel. Six people of the crew pretty much kept in what would be a studio apartment. Privacy issues are very high, he says. It would not be strange if someone was flipping out. Sarah alerts me to a recent incident where a man stabbed a colleague at a remote Arctic research station. Hibernation was certainly put paid to such bickering in space, which slows the goal of trauma prevention and interplanetary travel are both well within the orbit of human hibernation research, contingent on planets aligning, of course. What a big article.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.